Welcome back to Hakuna Lorcana, a worry-free podcast about the Disney stories we love and the Lorcana cards they inspire. I'm Caleb.
And I'm Katie. Today, we are talking about the 1963 classic film, The Sword and the Stone, where a young boy develops his brain under the tutelage of a whimsical wizard in order to bring England out of the Dark Ages. But before we dive into the lore, Caleb, how is your weekly lore count?
I would say my weekly lore count, as it's come to be known, would be right up there. I'm not going to give it a 20 because I fell short on Saturday, but I'll give it like a 19, I guess. And I'm really sorry that you had to be in the way of all that.
Yeah, I'm in the carnage of your 19 lore count. But
yeah, for anyone who was following along on Twitter, we had a small little constructed tournament at our LGS on Saturday. Just like 10 of us were there. And so we did four rounds of Swiss. And wouldn't you know it, Katie and Caleb had to face each other in the fourth round of Swiss. And winner made top cut. And
yeah, you hate to see it.
It was kind of brutal.
It was. But, you know, there's people you want to lose to. And there's people you don't want to lose to. And Caleb's a good guy to lose to because he knows what he's doing. He doesn't make you feel bad. So if I'm going to lose to anyone, I'll lose to Caleb. But I also lost to one other person, but also
well, shucks. Yeah, well, and your third round match, you lost to Luke, right?
Yeah, so the only two people I lost to was the first and second place people. So, yeah, I'll chalk that up as a medium win. But yes. Tell them about you, what happened.
Sure. So I'll talk about my tournament, and then you can talk about yours. So tournament went pretty good. I've mentioned it that I'm playing Ruby Sapphire right now, and that makes my deck pretty rude. But I got some things to work on Saturday. It felt good. I actually lost my first round to our friend Chris, who was playing Amber Ruby Mufasa. And he just had, like, S-tier top decks off of his Mufasas in our first game. Like, first game, I, like, banish his Mufasa with my Medusa. He top decks a Tremaine, so I have to banish my Medusa. Oh, you know, the second hurts. One, I banish it with like maybe another Medusa, or I banish it with something, and then he top decks a dragon. But in that case, you know, I actually had multiple characters on the field for him to choose, so he got to choose like my best one. And then he like also top decked another Mufasa at one point. He also got a Surfer Mini when he didn't need to banish any of my stuff. So his were like perfect. But then we ran it back in the first round of Top Cut. I played him and I was, you know, he didn't get quite as lucky with his Mufasas in that one. And I was able to win the first round of Top Cut against Chris. So yeah, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I always feel like those roulette decks or the Amber Ruby, it's like they giveth and they taketh. There's times where you're like, it's on fire. And then there are times where you're like, this is really painful. So,
yeah. He was
so you
telling
got to see
me
both.
Like, yeah, he was saying like, you know, normally on Pixelborn, I'll top deck Teeth and Ambitions like every single time. In this game, I didn't. And I was like, hey, you know, that's how it goes. And then we faced in Top Cut. The first Mufasa that I banished, he top decked the Teeth and Ambitions. So,
oh, gosh. Yeah. It hurts. Not for
it
you.
Does.
Hurts for him. Not for you.
Yeah. I felt for him, you know.
Yes.
I also am getting some foils in the mail for my deck for set championships. So I'm just full on committing to this Ruby Sapphire deck. And so I was able to get several singles so I can trick out my deck a little bit. So that makes me feel, you know, all fancy. I don't normally like get fancy stuff. You know, I'm a pretty like, you know, I'm going to buy a used car kind of guy. But this time I'm like, ooh, I'm going to go to the nines for my deck. So,
well, it's smart because then you can blind them. So even if like you're doing bad, you just shine the cards at them. And
it's
then
a distraction tool.
Advantage.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess in the world of Lorcana, some big news with the comprehensive rules coming out. So I'm pretty excited about that. When it first dropped, I was like, ooh, I'm going to be that guy that like prints it off and I'm going to make notes in the margins and stuff. And that hasn't happened yet. Don't know if it will. at some point I would like to read them, you know, front to back, but I don't know if I'm going to be the, you know, print it off guy. So I don't know. Have you looked at those yet?
No, but I trust the people around me. You know, I think I'll absorb the rules through osmosis, I think.
Yeah. So with comprehensive rules, you know, I saw that Jonty like read it live on YouTube. So props to him. And you know, Googly Glimmers. He's a great guy. He was on the Illumiteers show and the Inkwell with John Team B Squared. And he was talking all about the rules and everything like that. So, you know, those are some folks that are really getting after the rules that, you know, maybe one day I'll be like one of those guys. Who knows?
Yeah, you know, maybe I'll print them out just so I can carry them around and just look authoritative at tournaments.
Yeah.
So people will be like, wow, she knows what's up.
Yeah, just when you sit down across from your opponent at a challenge event, just like slam down like a stapled packet of the rules and... Oh, I was just going over.
No, I'm
going
to go.
Sorry, what?
Oh, I'm going to print it out with a spiral bound. I'm
gonna, oh, there you,
know,
you go.
Go to a paper printing place, a Kinko's. Do they still make Kinko's? I don't think
something
so.
Something like that.
I think, yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And just like in the middle of your turn, like you're referencing rules and then like not even audibly, you know, just pointing out.
I think it'll be good. It's a good. So, yeah, if you have your foiled out cards, rule book, no one's going to mess with you.
Yeah, no one can mess with you at that point. So. Anyways, that's how my week in lore has gone. What about you, Katie?
You know, I'm on the flip side again. You know, I say a five. That, you know, a five is, you know, one quarter way to 20.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a glass quarter way filled. Yeah. I think I made a bold call right before the tournament and was like, you know, I feel like items aren't usually such a big deal. Like normally, like, it's a problem, but if my deck's faster and stronger, then the items can't really get me.
Yeah.
So I took out my item removal. I took out Benja and I took out Rise of the Titans because I'm like,
who
cares?
Needs it?
Turns out, yeah. So then it turns out Ruby Sapphire and Sapphire Steel, they care.
They care.
They cared a lot
yeah.
because they stomped all over me in my cute little deck.
Yeah. Fishbone Quill and Lucky Dime. They'll get you.
Yeah. And it's tricky, too, because I learned the lesson the hard way. If you're going against any Sapphire deck and you're playing Amber Steel, you got to turn to Bare Necessities because you just got to get that stupid fishbone out of their hands. Like, it's just take it, burn it. You're like, you can't have it. So pretty much that was my lesson is if you can Bare Necessities, just do whatever you can to get that in your hand and play it turn two.
Yeah, Bare Necessities is such a powerful card on turn two. Because it can grab anything. It's not just songs. You know, that Ursula card in Emerald is great as well for snagging songs, but being able to discard locations or items or, you know, non-song action cards, like, that's super powerful. So, like, keeping me from ramping, I'm not even allowed to get Quill on the board. I mean, that's going to cripple my deck.
Yeah. So between Fishbone Quill and... I think I said on the Lion King episode, it's very weird how there's characters I never had any negative feeling towards. But now every time I see that stupid Cogsworth, I'm like, no. It's weird having such a powerful negative emotion to a clock. But
yeah.
Here I am.
Well, we can commiserate about Cogsworth together because I don't run Cogsworth in Ruby Sapphire. That's not a very common card there. But in Sapphire Steel, he's very common. And that ward ability, I think, hurts both of us. Both Steel and Ruby decks like to be choosing characters a lot. And when you can't choose Cogsworth, it kind of stinks.
Yeah, and it's brutal because even if I get to grab your swords, it's not enough. It's not enough.
Yeah.
So it's brutal. So I don't know. So it was rough. And I think it was hard going from I was feeling so good. I had two 2-0 rounds where I'm like unbeatable, the best. And then, I running into the person who came in first place and then you who came in second.
Yeah.
And then getting cut. And I was like, well, anyway, see you guys. But I still think it's good because at the end of the day, I'm somebody where I have a hard time psyching myself up to go to tournaments. Mm-hmm. I will talk myself out of it in a minute's notice.
Yeah.
Just because... It's uncomfortable to sometimes put yourself out there.
Yeah.
It's hard because, I mean, I always assume everyone around me is way smarter and way better than I am.
I do the same thing.
Yeah. So I hear one person say one technical detail. I'm like, great. They're a genius.
Yeah.
And, I'm in my head too much.
Yeah. It can be intimidating. You know, showing up to a tournament, it takes a lot of... It's not like showing up to League, you know, and if it's something that's new for you, like, you know, anybody that's listening, it is a step. And so there are things you can do that can kind of take the edge off, you know, playing with people that you know, playing at a shop that's familiar to you, things like that. I highly recommend it. But, you know, with set championships coming up, my hope is that anyone who would want to win a stitch feels like they're comfortable to, like, go to an event to win one, you know? And so if you need, yeah, like, someone to hype you up, you know, the Hakuna Larkana team is there for you.
Yeah. I won't hype myself up, but I'll hype you up for sure, yeah, whoever it is.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes there can be that added element of sometimes being a girl, a female, sure, in a TCG. You show up, you're like, oh, I'm the only one here. And so I think, yeah, it's also getting into the mindset of everyone there is nice. I've never had anyone ever be mean to me in a tournament, yeah, but it's that mental barrier when you walk, sure, in and you look around the room, you're like, oh, these people, they're all better than me, and I'm just some silly, I'm just a kid, even though I'm 34, I'm not a kid, yeah, but you just feel like that, yeah, little kid in school again.
Yeah.
But I think you should go, because I think it's the best way to learn. It's learning, it's drinking from a fire hose, because, yeah, you learn so much just in one tournament about what works, what doesn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's the best way to get better is to go to tournaments. Obviously, playing with friends is good.
Yeah.
League is good. But a tournament is where you're really
Put to the test. Kinda,
yeah, yeah. And doing and kind of like seeing how disciplined you are, which I know that sounds kind of crazy from being like a game. But, I mean, how good are you at your triggers? How good are you at remembering what the other decks are? Because that's so much of the game, is thinking about what the next person, will play.
What could they have in their hand? What cards could they be running in their deck?
Yeah,
yeah, being able to do all of that in real time. You know, the deck building skill is a thing of its own. But, like, yeah, being able to pilot your deck and, like, play at a good pace so that you're not slow playing, but you're still playing optimally. All of those things get learned in a tournament setting. And so I've always seen tournaments as a place to get, like, really high quality games and a place to be able to play people that I might not ever play against. And that's, to me, that's worth the cost of admission on its own. Even if I don't walk away with a prize of any kind, like, I got, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 rounds of high quality Larkana in. And I wouldn't have gotten that had I not gone to the tournament, you know?
Exactly. So to anyone listening that's thinking, like, I don't know, should I, shouldn't, I think you should. I mean, if you're somebody, yeah, who, I would say, you know, people will say, oh, the meta, I don't like the meta. The meta, which for those who might not know, like, the meta is kind of, you know, what's good, what's bad, what are people playing?
Yeah.
It'd probably be hard to go into a tournament without having, like, a little bit of knowledge of the decks that people are playing. Because,
yeah,
you know, that gives you competitive edge. But I will say, if you show up with a random deck, you're going to freak out everyone, because no one will know what you're about to do.
No
next,
one will know what's going on. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. They'll be like, what is that deck? You'll be like, it's mine. And,
yeah,
nobody knows. And so,
yeah,
so that's the one advantage. If you don't know the meta, then you will have the element of surprise on everyone.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so, yeah, just do it. You just kind of got to everybody has a first tournament, you know, so, yes, might as well get it out of the way.
Yeah. And what if you do great and then you get a Rockstar Stitch and you get to carry it around and show everyone every day for the rest of your life, which,
yeah,
is what I'm going,
exactly,
to do.
Exactly. Totally worth it.
So yeah, I'm encouraged too to see that, as we speak of the meta, I'm encouraged to see how healthy it was, because, you know, last set, everyone was like, there's only one deck that's good. It's the,
yeah,
only deck of Ruby, Amethyst.
Yeah.
Yeah, Amethyst Ruby. And so that was like the one deck, but our top four had no Amethyst,
Zero Amethyst. I mean, there was only one deck, yeah, out of the 10 that was running Amethyst, I think.
Yeah.
My buddy Leon was playing Ruby Amethyst, but yeah, otherwise everybody else was like, there was a lot of steel. There was quite, mm-hmm, there's a bit of Ruby, a bit of Amber. Well, no, there was one hyper aggro deck that also ran Amethyst, so maybe there were two Amethyst decks out.
Yeah. There wasn't, like, we all showed up and we're like, hey, we all have the same deck. Let's just play mirror matches all day.
Yeah.
So that was a good encouraging sign to me.
Yeah.
Is that as the game matures, there's different niches of what people like to play, what they don't. For example, I was telling Caleb, I'm praying Sapphire is not the only competitive deck, because I physically cannot handle the mental math it takes to be a Sapphire player. So,
I've embraced the Sapphire life, and I have to pay for it, you know, pretty much between terms. I'm always counting, like, how much ink I have so that when my turn comes up, I, like, know what I'm working with.
That's good. So. Yeah. Cause I played 2 rounds with my husband and I was like, yeah, I'm never going to play this deck again. That was really stressful. There was so much ink. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I had like 10 cards in my hand and 40 ink. And I'm like, what do I do?
What's even going on? Yeah.
Yeah. So moving on to the topic of the day.
Yes.
We're talking about the Sword and the Stone. So as always, Caleb, tell me about your background with the Sword and the Stone.
Yeah. So the Sword and the Stone is a movie that makes me think of my dad. That's like immediately what I think of when I think of being a kid and, you know, we're going to go watch a movie as a family or something like that. When we would watch The Sword and the Stone, it's because that's the one that dad wanted to watch. And there was something endearing about it. You know, it's probably because he grew up watching it. He was, you know, born in the early 60s. And so it was around when he was that age. I've just always had a fond memory of it. I've also had kind of a, like, an uneasy, like, relationship to it in the sense that, like, I remember as a kid watching it and, like, really empathizing with Arthur and feeling like, oh, this kid, like, can't catch a break. Like, all of the adults around him are super harsh on him. And I was a pretty, shy and, like, kind of sensitive kid. And so I was like, if I was in Arthur's shoes, like, I would be so stressed out. And so it was a little anxiety inducing, I remember, as a kid to watch the movie. But as I rewatched it, you know, in prepping for the episode, I was like, I really enjoyed the movie. So, yeah, Katie, what about you? What's your relationship to Sword and the Stone?
Well, this has been stressful for me because I even messaged you today and I'm like, I'm going to do my best here today, Caleb. But yeah. I don't have the background that a lot of people have with this movie. I didn't see it until yesterday for the first time.
Okay.
So all that, those rose-colored nostalgia glasses of making me think of certain times, it makes me think of nothing.
Yep.
Other than the anvil with the sword and, I mean, the sword and the stone, I guess, in the parks, because I'd see it and be like, that's fun.
Yeah.
But I'd never seen the movie. And there's a few Disney movies I haven't seen, but it's not that I haven't seen them. It's that I've never sat down and watched them. Like, I feel like I've absorbed them through osmosis.
Sure. You just kind of know, like, what they're, you know, about, like, and different characters.
Yeah, I've seen it from being at friend's house or watching it on TV for 10 minutes. Like, I've seen it. But this one, no. I don't think I've ever – I didn't know what to expect at all.
Yeah.
And I have a theory on this. You mentioned last week you're the older sibling, correct?
Yes, I'm the oldest of four.
Yeah, so I'm the youngest of three.
Okay.
So my current theory, because my sister will give me a lot of flack. She's like, I can't believe you've never seen this, this, and this.
Yeah.
But she's my older sibling. So in theory, this is technically on her. But then I was also thinking that, you know, when you're the oldest, you're like putting on movies for your siblings. So then you had a lot of chances to see movies over and over again because, you know, there was kids behind you that would want to see the movie. So that's my current theory on why I haven't seen as many Disney movies as older siblings, is that, you know, I didn't have to watch them after I was a kid, you know, but you had to keep watching them with all your family as they grew up.
Yeah, that is a good point, is when I firmly believe, in defense of all oldest siblings out there, that we are undoubtedly the guinea pigs. Yeah, I mean, this is just like known fact, you know.
Yes.
And so
that's science.
Yeah, it's scientifical, as they say, and so that means, you know, parents are trying whatever it is on their oldest child, and like sometimes it's great, so they keep doing it with the other ones, and then other times they're like, oh, that didn't work, so we won't do it again. And, you know, maybe Sword in the Stone was a movie like that. Like, oh, it didn't work for Katie's oldest sibling. So I'm not going to speak for your family. That's for sure. I have no idea. But
who knows?
Yeah,
but
who knows?
This is, maybe she listens. I think she does listen to my podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's her fault, but it's not her fault.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, we can't say definitively like one way or another. So.
Yeah, right. I can either confirm or deny that. So, yeah. But last night was my first night's watching, so I'll get into a little bit more as we go. But,
sure.
But yeah.
Yeah, so let's jump into it. So The Sword and the Stone was released on Christmas Day, actually. You know, I thought Christmas Day movies was like a thing that started when I was like in middle school or something. Guess not. Yeah. Guess they were doing Christmas Day movies back in 1963. So Sword and the Stone was released on Christmas Day, 1963, and was directed by Wolfgang Riethermann, Wooly. Wolfgang Wooley Reitherman, who is part of a revered group of contributors to the early days of Walt Disney Productions that's referred to as like the Nine Old Men, which is, I don't know, like something about Lord of the Rings comes to mind or something like that.
But they did each have a ring, fortune buyer.
I don't know much about I just want to do this like little aside. Do you know much about the Nine Old Men?
No, because I mean, as you can see, apparently there's this like weird space in my Disney knowledge about anything from this time period. Okay, so,
fair enough.
But I do know that name, and it's very prestigious, revered. Like they are like the founding fathers, essentially, sure, of what we know of Disney animation.
Exactly. And even though the title Nine Old Men, like today would be like maybe a diss, like I'm sure back in the day it wasn't. Like it does sound like something that's like distinguished. And so, you know, as we venture through all these Disney movies and the history, you know, of Disney animation, like maybe we'll learn more about them. Who knows?
Yeah, right. This is the first of many times I'm sure it'll come up. Yeah,
that it'll come up. So the film was notable because it was the first sole director of a Disney animated feature. So before I think this is the 18th animated feature, like Walt Disney animated feature, and the 17 that preceded it had more than one director. So this was the first one that only had one director, which is pretty interesting. The score was composed by George Bruns, or Bruns, I think, one of those two. And he actually won an Academy Award for his score. So it was nominated for one Academy Award, and it got the win for the musical score.
Yeah, and I'm going to do a compliment sandwich with this one. Okay, so I will say the score, I love the score of old Disney movies because I love the characterization that they do with music. That music is pretty much going from the start of the film to the end as they're walking.
Yeah.
There's like walking sounds, thinking sounds. Like that is so wonderful and so charming in old Disney movies. And this one that kind of stuck out to me is that it just has this very rich feeling because the score is always kind of underpinning everything that's going on. But now this is where this is our first controversial take.
Sure.
And it's not being negative. It's just current Disney movies are super linear with their plot, very classic.
Sure.
Where it's like, this is the exposition. Then we're going to start. We're going to meet our hero. They're going to go on a hero's journey. There's going to be a climax. And then there's going to be a payoff of what they've been doing for the past, you know, hour and a half.
Yeah.
This was not that.
Nope.
No, I was so surprised because the first like 5 minutes, they're like, oh, this is about, not Excalibur. That's different. But, you know, old England and finding a king, Sword in the Stone. I was thinking very like, okay, this is gonna be like Hercules, but with like a cute little kid and a wizard. And so I was ready. And then they just transformed into animals for an hour straight. Just an hour straight of whimsical little activities, which was fun. But I was like, I kept looking at the clock and I'm like, we only have like 30 minutes left.
Yeah.
And so then I was looking at the clock and there was, by the time we met Madame Mim, who I was convinced was going to be just like the enemy, maybe?
Yeah, villain? Like Maleficent. Like she shows up at the beginning and like she's evil the whole way through. Yeah.
Yeah. Nope, Madame Mim shows up at 22 minutes left. Yeah, and I'm not even sure she's a villain so much as just an eccentric old lady who's kind of okay with child murder, which makes you a villain, but she's not really against anything he's trying to do. Like, she's not trying to stop somebody from becoming the King of England, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, she's just, like, clearly mentally unstable, you know?
Yeah, she's just a kooky old lady.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I noted is, so, like, the Wizard's Duel happens, which I knew that was going to happen from Lorcana.
From
I was
cards.
Like, okay, I know that's. But then after that was done, there's 10 minutes left in the film. So I'm just looking, I'm panicking. I'm like, what are we going to do?
Where
He's still a bird right now.
Where are we going from
here? Yeah, and so they're like, oh, by the way, we're going into the town. And he's like, oh, I just found a sword and a stone. And he pulls it, and they're like, movie's over. And I was like, what was that? So the pacing was just a wild ride.
It's a little bit flashy.
We spent a lot of time as a squirrel for a boy about to become the King of England. So that was unexpected. But I will say, so compliment sandwich, this is the happy bread on the other side.
Yes, yes.
Is the characters carry you through it. Like all the characters are so lovely and fun and everything they say is so, you know, good. So I think it's remarkable because, you know, you have a movie with not the most deep plot you've ever seen in a Disney movie.
Sure.
I mean, talking about Lion King, we're like, oh, it's like Macbeth.
Yeah.
This is a lot more, you know, just things happening, but yeah. It's so memorable because of, you know, how they did it. It's pretty, it looks good. So yeah, that's my compliment sandwich. Do you have any thoughts on that? Am I canceled for my hot takes?
Absolutely not. I think that's, I honestly have like similar thoughts from when I was watching it as a kid, because I do remember watching it several times and thinking like, what is this movie about? Like,
yeah, it's a good question.
I don't really know what it's about. Whereas, you know, a lot of the so many other Disney movies and movies that are made for kids, I think they probably figured out in time, like, oh, we should probably make this pretty obvious for kids, like what this is about, so that they stay engaged. Yeah. Because if I don't know why they're jumping from limb to limb as squirrels, then, you know, we might lose the kids. So I don't know. I do have distinct memories of like, yeah, I don't really know what this movie is about, but it is pretty fun, you know.
Yeah, and they spend like an alarmingly long time as the animals. It's not just like, oh, I'm a fish, I'm a bird. It's like, no, we're going to be a squirrel for the next 10 minutes, and we're going to have a song about squirrels and love. And it was cute, and I liked it, but I was also like, we have a lot to cover, right? And they're like, no, don't worry about it. And they did. They got through it.
This. Yeah.
Yeah, and at the end, he's king. That's, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with the end result, but the journey was stressful as a person that, you know, I've always constantly been thinking about pacing in a movie. So that sure. was stressful, looking and be like, we got 10 minutes left for this kid to become the king of England. And
yeah,
they did it, so I shouldn't have been stressed. They pulled it off.
Yeah, and you know, we should just jump into the three fun facts then, because you know, you brought up Shakespeare, Lion King, based off of Hamlet. Not Macbeth, by the way, but I can, you know.
Oh, sorry. You know, 50-50 it's, of the
it's,
ones with
it's
the
one
name.
Of those Shakespeare ones, yeah, that right? we read in high school. And you know, this is based off of like pre-existing lore. This is Arthurian fantasy. That's like its own genre, I've come to learn. And it's based off of a book written by this guy, T.H. White. So The Sword and the Stone is like the name of a small, like 200-page book that was published in 1938. So, you know, I would have thought like, oh yeah, like, oh, if this is about King Arthur, then, you know, the source material has to be from like the 17th or 18th century or something like that. But it isn't. But, you know, T.H. White got his inspiration off of like much older Arthurian fantasy sources that do date back, you know, in the fantastical ethos of, you know, English storytelling. So there is like a lineage there, but that's where the specific story is pretty much based on. You know, you mentioned Excalibur. The Sword and the Stone is never called that. And like the tale of like Excalibur isn't like quite the same as the Sword and the Stone, but it's not unrelated either. You know, there might be some people listening right now that are like, how do you not know the differences between the Sword and the Stone and Excalibur? And I just have to say, I'm so sorry that I've let you down.
Well, I was going to say, I did just check. We have 10 downloads from England and 3 from Scotland. So for those 13 people, I
let us know.
Apologize. Yeah. Well, and also sorry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, America has 300 years of history.
Yeah.
You guys have like a lot more than that. So
and
the line, like Caleb was saying, the line between history and literature, it gets blurry.
Yeah. Not only that, but I'm from Colorado, you're from Nebraska. We live in landlocked US, you know.
We're not cultured.
We have certain streams of culture. In Colorado, it mainly has to do with skiing and, you know, green chilies or something like that. But it doesn't extend.
But ancient Arthurian
that.
Legends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not as much.
Not quite our forte. So anyways, yeah, so The Sword and the Stone is like book was eventually put into like a collection of books called The Once and Future King, that you can get like these 4 books combined into one. So The Sword and the Stone is kind of like the origin story of King Arthur, which is what we get in the movie. And then the second book is The Queen of Air and Darkness, also sometimes called The Witch in the Wood. The third book is called The Ill-Made Knight, and that one has to do with the character of Lancelot. And then the last book in the bundle is called The Candle and the Wind. And then there's a fifth one that was published post-mortem called The Book of Merlin, which was also written by White, but again, published after he had passed. And so that's kind of like a, if fantasy is your thing, you know, in doing my research, it actually has like really good reviews. So if you kind of want to get into some Arthurian fantasy source materials, you know, The Once and Future King by T.H. White might be the place to start.
Now, is the, I don't know if you found this in your research, but is the Queen of Air and Darkness Madame Mim? Is there overlap that you saw? Because I mean, she is.
Yeah, I didn't get that far in.
Oh, that's okay.
I don't even know if Mim is like the name of a character in the books. That might be a Disney thing. I know that there is like a witch antagonist that does show up.
Okay.
And that could be the subject of the title of the second book. I couldn't tell you.
Well, feel free if you're at home, if you're in your car and you're screaming, you're like, I've read all 5 books.
Yeah.
Definitely send us an email because I would love to know.
Yeah, we would love to be filled in.
I'll probably forget. Yes, I'll forget to Google after this. So send me an email.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know, Arthurian like fantasy stuff is just the history of like King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and Sir Lancelot and Lady Guinevere and that kind of stuff is, I've always felt like I've known it's of its existence, but it's always kind of been tangential. I guess like the most exposure I've had to that sort of stuff is through like Monty Python and the Holy Grail or
yes.
like a Knight's Tale lesson. Or something. Yes.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I think the Knight's Tale is based on Canterbury's Tales. And Canterbury Tales...
Is it? Was, okay.
I think so. Well, now I don't... Oh, gosh. This is going to be a lot of our first episode where people are just be like, you're wrong on everything.
But, yeah.
So I assume this was something that came from, you know, in high school you read Beowulf and Canterbury Tales. So I was like, oh, yeah, it's probably from the olden days. So
yeah.
That's why I was surprised to see that it was 1938 because I was like, what? But... I don't know. So, the line between history and fiction gets a little blurry. Like I said, when it comes to medieval stuff, it's kind of like Game of Thrones isn't historical fiction. But in my mind, sometimes I'm like, yeah, this is the olden days. But
yeah.
Like, no, this isn't. It's so, yeah. So I'm sorry, England.
Yeah.
You don't deserve what I'm saying about you.
Yeah. We're misrepresenting your culture. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So we do apologize for that.
It is. We do. Sincerely. But also, it was a good tale to get me excited about it because you know sometimes you watch movies like this and Hercules and the rest of the night you're just Googling and
yeah.
Wikipedia and you're just going clicking and clicking so
yeah.
That was a good part of this movie as I did last night. I was doing some of my own secret research because I was like, was this based on a book or history?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's fascinating how sometimes it's a little bit of both.
Yep.
But I don't know if that's the case in this case. I think it's not. Was there King Arthur?
You know, that's for the listeners to tell us.
Yes, that's actually great. That's a great listener question. So we want to know if you know.
Yeah, I would love to be thoroughly educated on such a matter. So
exactly.
It is fun to think about. You know, fantasy is fun, like fun to think about. And I guess not. I don't have a whole lot of experience with Arthurian fantasy, so to say. But like, you know, Tolkien and Lord of the Rings and then, you know... like Harry Potter and stuff like that. Like all that stuff is super fun. So thinking about magic and like Merlin and knights and swords and, you know, that kind of stuff. It's fun to think about.
Exactly. I'm a big fan. Colorado, kind of south of Denver has this giant Renaissance fair and it's not giant compared to all the ones in the world, but it's giant compared to ones that are small. It's like one of those permanent Renaissance fairs. Have you been?
Oh yeah. I went in middle school one time and yeah, ate my turkey leg and saw the jousting, like super fun.
Oh yeah. It's a day of I'll eat everything on a stick. And I assume that's how it was back then too.
Yeah.
Is everything was on a stick.
For sure.
But that was a good fact. The 1938 thing is what sticks out to me the most though. Cause I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that is, it is unique. I was surprised myself. Okay. Well, so for the second fun fact, you know, when you think about Disney, you think, at least for me, I do think of animals. I mean, The Lion King is my favorite, Disney movie. And when I think about all of the iconic kind of animal-based Disney movies, I would say Sword in the Stone does not necessarily come to mind, but I do think after rewatching it for this, for the pod, I firmly believe it should be considered like an animal Disney movie, just like Bambi, just like Aristocats, just like Lion King, just like Zootopia, simply because of the number of animals that, exist in the movie. So I rewatched the movie simply to count the number of different animals that show mm-hmm. up throughout the movie. And I think there's 30 different animals that show up in the movie. You know, the movie immediately opens, after the book scene, with a wolf and a squirrel and a hawk. And then we see Archimedes the owl after, we see Merlin, and it just kind of goes on from there. The wolf character, I think, is actually pretty funny. He reminded me a lot of Wile E. Coyote a little bit. You know, he's kind of...
Yeah, coyote vibes.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he had just some comic relief, and he's, like, always trying to get after what he's hunting, but he can never get it. You know, and then they go into the moat around the castle, and they get turned into fish, and there's the frog and the catfish and the pike that tries to eat them. Then there's squirrels, and there's the red woodpecker. Like, and then, you know, we'll get into the wizard's duel for sure. But like, I was just surprised as to, like, you know, for screen time, as far as humans versus animals, I got to imagine it's like at least 50-50, if not more animals than, you know, humans that are on the screen.
Yeah, very surprising to me. That did not expect that at all. And then I was like, oh. And later we find out this poor kid can't read. And he's like, no, we're going to go be an animal again.
Yeah.
He's fine.
Yeah.
So yeah. Learning to read,
we can do that later. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, not important. Anyway, let's go be a little bird.
Yeah. And flying for our life away from a hawk. That's a way better use of our time.
Yeah. That's called... you know, the fight or flight, or sink or swim learning. So,
yeah.
Which is apropos, given he was a fish for some point of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was pretty surprised by all the animal scenes. I knew he was going to be at least one animal, but I was surprised that he was a fish and he was a squirrel. And then after that, he's like, okay, we got to be a bird. It's like it was a lot. It was a lot of little animals.
Yeah, a lot of little animals. You know, Merlin didn't even change into like big animals himself. I think the goat was like the biggest one he turned into. Arthur's getting turned into like a little fish and a little squirrel and a little bird. And speaking of a little bird, that's when we finally get to meet Madame Mim. You know, we've been waiting so long to finally meet her. So yeah, Madame Mim, she finally gets introduced when Wart, or Arthur, is a sparrow. And... it's just so funny that she like immediately goes into like shape shifting, and she like turns her face into a hog's face, you know, and then she's like the attractive lady, and then like they go into the wizard's duel, and I just find it so funny like that this is like what a wizard's duel looks like in this universe, you know. I mm-hmm. think about other like fantasy realms, and like when witches and wizards like try to showcase their powers. I don't know. Shapeshifting into animals isn't necessarily one way to, I would think, to necessarily show off your prowess for your magical abilities. But I guess that's
Merlin
where
they landed.
Do.
Well, yeah, landed. Imagine if the seventh Harry Potter movie, they're like, all right, Harry Potter, the boy who lived, now come to wizard battle. And they're like, chaos ensues. So it would have been a different
movie. Can you imagine?
Yeah, very different.
Oh my goodness.
A different tone.
Yeah. Gandalf and Saruman are, you know, going at it, and they just start turning into different animals.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
how iconic would that be?
So, I poo-pooed it, but it's fun, you know. Merlin was not as good as Mim. I will say that Merlin was pulling a lot of not good animals to be in a battle with. So,
Yeah, we probably should coach Merlin up a little bit because, you know, turning into a caterpillar or a mouse. I was a little, it was a little sus, whereas Mim, you know, she was responding, you know, like she turned into the hen when he turned into a caterpillar. So, mm-hmm. you know, still not like an S tier pick, but overall her choices of animal seemed to be better than Merlin at the end of the day. So.
She had been practicing on Wizard Pixelborn. You could tell.
Yeah. Oh, she was grinding for sure. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, I would agree that Sword in the Stone is definitely more animal movie than not an animal movie.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I just need to like file it away in my brain that way. Mm-hmm. because yeah, I mean, Mim turns into a cat, a crocodile, a fox, a hen, an elephant, a tiger, a snake, a rhino, and then her purple dragon, of course. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Merlin is a turtle, a rabbit, a caterpillar, a walrus, a mouse, a crab, a goat. He turns back into a mouse. And then finally, he's a germ, which is kind of interesting, but leads into my third fun fact, which is anachronisms. Katie, do you know what the word anachronism means?
Oh, I sure do. Do you want me to tell the audience?
Please.
Okay. So it's something out of the time period. Like it shouldn't be there. It's out of place time-wise, but it's there.
And I guess the writers got inspired to do this for Merlin because I guess it, I don't know if this is a spoiler, I guess in T.H. White's writing of the books, there are like a few anachronisms in his writings where he, like allows Merlin to have knowledge of like future scientific understandings. Right. And so I think the writers of this, of the movie were like, oh yeah, let's like just make that Merlin's entire personality. So like from the very beginning of the movie, you know, he's like trying to pull up the water from the well and he's just like complaining. He's like, dark ages indeed, like no plumbing, no electricity. Mm-hmm. And basically throughout the entire movie, like Merlin is breaking that fourth wall and referencing like scientific discoveries that happen later down the line. And in fact, there's a point where him and Archimedes are talking about like, Archimedes is like, he can't learn history backwards. Like there's only one way to learn history, you know? And it is kind of funny, like how meta they get about like, understanding and learning and things like that. To the point where the entire movie finishes, like the last line that gets said before it ends is, you know, Merlin's like, I bet books will be written about you. Maybe even a motion picture, which is like television, but without commercials. You know, like I'm pretty sure that's the last word that's said in the movie is commercials.
Yeah, I was a little flabbergasted at that because I was like, oh, that's how we're going to end the movie is like a meta joke. And
yeah.
But my sister pointed out something very interesting to me that, so I was dogging on the movie a little bit, but she pointed out that one of the reasons Merlin is nice to Arthur is because he knows that when Arthur gets older, he's going to have like, he's going to be a king and it's going to be like, you know, king stuff, medieval, I'm sure, bad. So he was really nice to Arthur because he knows his future, which I think that's nice. I think that's a nice way to think about it is that he knows.
And that's kind of why, you know, before Arthur and Merlin even meet, Merlin's like, oh, I don't know who it's going to be, but I know somebody's going to be here. And the reason Merlin's doing all of this is because he knows Arthur is going to be king one day, even though nobody else knows it. And you also get the feeling that Merlin doesn't know how he's going to become king, but he just knows that he is. And so he's investing in this boy, trying to teach him. And, you know, there is something noble about it. At the end of the day, I think the message that they're trying to get across, kind of like the moralism of the movie, is, you know, brain over brawn, so to say. Like, you have the contrast between Arthur and Kay, and, you know, Kay's just this kind of bumbling guy who's, you know, whose dad wants him to be the king, and he's going to do that through jousting, whereas Merlin knows that Arthur is going to be king, and instead of teaching him also how to joust, he's teaching him how to overcome adversity and you know, through getting hunted by a pike fish and by being hunted by a hawk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You would say he developed his brain, so to speak.
Yes.
So
exactly.
So yeah, that I thought was interesting. The whole, I think we're spoiled in modern day movies where you can't just say, oh yeah, I can time travel without explaining it. So I think my modern brain was like, well, how, what are the rules? What can he say? What can he not? That's not important. So I had to like throw that out the window that Merlin can time travel. That's fine. Okay. That's it.
Yeah.
And then You don't ask questions. So
yeah, suspending your disbelief for a little while during the Sword and the Stone will definitely serve you well.
Yes.
yeah, if you let just go. Kind of take it in for what it is.
Exactly. So yeah, those are good facts. That yeah, it's a classic movie, an animal movie, and a time travel movie.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. You know, Merlin gets to go to Bermuda. Yes. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I liked his outfit when he came back. That would be a fun card. Yeah. We haven't gotten to that section yet, but when I saw that, I was like, ooh, vacation Merlin.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of reminded me of Genie when he comes back at the, you know, he's like, exactly. I'm free. And he's like, okay, vacation time. You know, him and Merlin are like, and they're also magical beings. So, it wouldn't surprise me if Merlin and Genie, you know, are hanging out in Bermuda together.
Exactly. They're contemporaries. Anybody's a contemporary when you're a time traveler. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, the Sword and the Stone, it was featured very prominently in set 2, Rise of the Floodborn. So there's been 18 cards total so far from Ravensburger, 14 of which were just from the second set. A lot of those were where Madame Mim and Merlin were having that wizard battle, which you could kind of see a little bit of. Not all the cards were in the Might and Magic Amethyst Steel starter deck. So all in, so far we've seen 6 Merlin, 4 Madame Mims, 2 Arthurs, 1 Archimedes, and then 2 actions, 2 songs, and 1 item. So it's kind of crazy how much of it is. I kind of forgot that there was some in set 1. Last night I was like, oh, I guess there were 4 cards. Archimedes obviously being one of them in the first set. And Develop Your Brain. Yeah. So for you, are there any ones that really stand out either before you watch the movie or after you watch the movie where you're like, man, I love this card?
Well, when the game came out and we just had the set 1 cards, I was very happy to see that there were Sword and the Stone cards in the first place. So, you know, to see the common Merlin card in Sapphire, he has support. I thought that was cool. I always thought Develop Your Brain was a good card. I didn't really see a use for Befuddle like at all. And then now that I see like some of these aggro decks using it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's like a super powerful card. So then when Rise of the Floodborn came out and they like started revealing all these cards, it really like blew my mind that they would go this hard for a movie that I would consider to be pretty niche. Mm-hmm. Like it's a beloved Disney movie without a doubt, but it's still like a pretty, like you said, you hadn't seen it before. But they still, I mean, they went all out in Rise of the Floodborn with these Merlin and Mim cards.
Yeah, they went all in. The fact that during the spoilers I was like, is the entire set just gonna be Madame Mim, Merlin, and 7 dwarfs? And the answer was a lot of it. Yeah,
pretty much. It wasn't short of that, that's for sure.
Yeah,
so some of the cards that stand out to me, I love the Merlin animal cards. The fact that they like get to do something mm-hmm. when you play them and when they leave play, I think like that's just like a brilliant mechanic in general, and it's really fun to play with. I mean, Merlin Goat, obviously, and Rabbit, they speak for themselves. Like they're tremendous cards. I love to see that Merlin Crab has gotten a lot of play now, especially with locations.
Yeah.
You know, Merlin Crab is like a really great way to deal with locations. So I'm glad to see that card's getting a lot of play for sure. I think Arthur Wizard's Apprentice was a card that really impressed me when Rise of the Floodborn was released. And, you know, it is a little niche. Like, it doesn't belong in every Amethyst deck, but I still think that card is a very good card. Like, getting to quest for 3, you get to bounce something back. So you get to, you know, get more cards off of Rabbit or a little bit more lore off of Goat or something like that. And then Purple Dragon, legendary card, Madame Mim, evasive 5/7 with 4 lore. I think it kind of just suffers from the same fate that Mickey Brave Little Taylor has kind of suffered from. But, I want it to be good, just like I want Mickey BLT to be like a played card. I really would love to see Madame Mim Purple Dragon played as well. So,
yeah, I had her sitting in my deck. So I played Amethyst Ruby for all of set 2. And I originally had her in my deck, but she's hard because you have to sacrifice essentially two creatures, which, you know, if it's one with a bounce back ability, that's not so bad. But it's like you have to get to the end of the game. You have to have two creatures out there, and then you have to just pray that since you're late in the game, the other person doesn't have a Dragonfire or something to just immediately remove her. So I found that, like BLT, it's just such a long slog to get to it, and then so fragile that you're like, okay, well, that was a lot of work to get to something where it doesn't always pay off. But another one, Arthur. I ran Arthur in my deck too, and I hope he comes back. He's really powerful, but also very fragile. And that's the sad thing about that card is because you have to wait that one turn, because so many people are running steel. I mean, gosh, you can't get past one turn in steel. There's so many ways to kill that poor child.
Yeah. The 1-3 stat line that he has is a popular stat line. Like, I would say overall it's a good stat line, but it gets exponentially worse the higher cost your card is. You know, like if you're a 1-cost with a 1-3 stat line, that's great. If you're a 3-cost character with a 1-3 stat line, then trying to live to see turn 4 can be tough.
Yeah, and there's just so many ways to tap him down. Smash. He's a fragile child, and I think that's why it can be hard to run him in a deck, because you just have to pray that the other deck has somehow no removal on turn 3, which a lot do now. But I love that card. I love it so much that I had a Aladdin Enchanted, and I traded him for Arthur, and I hadn't even seen the movie yet. I just love that sweet little boy. Aww. And I was like,
yeah, his Enchanted is super cool. I love that both him and Mim got an Enchanted. I mean, just to even reemphasize, like, the amount of love this movie got in Rise of the Floodborne. Like, both Enchanteds for Amethyst in Rise of the Floodborne were from this movie.
Yeah, it's like, very impressive. That's pretty cool. And impressive if you think about, I actually have both of those Enchanteds because I like them. I like bought one and traded for the other. And it was purely just based on how I like the cards. And I have to say, as a person who liked the Madam Mim Enchanted and Purple Dragon, I was like, wow, I can't wait to see her in the movie. And then I'm like an hour in, I'm like, Mim, when you coming? And then she came. So she did come. But I liked the characters before I even met them, that I had already liked them. So But on the flip side, are there any cards that you're like, I don't want to see that card? I mean, I think all the bounce cards, obviously, but are there any specific cards that you're like, I dread
it? I love having the bounce cards in my deck.
Yes.
I just don't want them in my opponent's deck.
Exactly. <know? laughs>
I do want to talk about Madam Mim Fox. That card is broken. I don't say that lightly.
I know. I've heard that take. And as a person who runs her, I'm like, you're broken. I think she's perfect, but I'd love to hear why is
and
she broken.
I do think people run to that word broken a little too fast.
Yes.
I actually don't. I would, if there's going to be a ban list, I would probably put one or two cards on that list. I think a Whole New World could go on there, and then Madam Mim Fox. And it's because it's just like a combination of a lot of really good things, where if one of those things was taken away to maybe make her a little more balanced, then I don't think she would be quite as broken as she is. Like, the fact that she has Rush and is inkable is just crazy. You know, the most comparable character we have to Madam Mim Fox, I would say, is Rafiki, which we've talked about before on the show. You know, he's the... from the first chapter, 3-cost, has Rush, but he is uninkable and has one less strength, and he doesn't get to bounce a character back to his hand, which you kind of, when you first read it, you're like, okay, that seems like a downside. Like, you can't play the character unless there's another character already on the board, so that does seem kind of like a downside, but it's just the fact that she has Rush, I think, that really makes it feel unfair to me, whereas Madam Mim Snake feels just so much more, she does feel balanced to me. I don't think there's anything wrong with Madam Mim Snake. I think that card does belong in the game, but the fact that Madam Mim, you know, you can quest with your Madam Mim Snake from turn 2, get a lore, bounce that snake back to hand so you can use it later, then Madam Mim Fox can rush into something. It just feels so, it's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree that it's definitely, I always sometimes raise my eyebrows at some of the rares. I'm like, how are you a rare? You're like really better than a few of the legendaries.
Yeah.
But yeah. I will say that, I mean, she's powerful, but I mean, no Madam Mims made it into the top four of the 10-person tournament we were at. So
sure.
So, you know, it's I think true. Because she's a three toughness, she's in the same boat as Arthur, where, you know, there's several ways to, but the fact that she has Rush, obviously, it's a problem. So I would agree that she's definitely a menace. She's a menace to people everywhere. But I don't know. I go back and forth on bans because I'm afraid. I'm a Magic player, so I am like, I'm not a Magic player. But I was briefly, and
you played
it was so brutal to be like, I love this card. And they're like, you love it? Really? It's gone. Oh, and so,
Gone.
So I don't, well, I hope they're very, very hesitant and very cautious about pressing that button too soon and too often.
Sure.
Because, I mean, so a card can be very powerful, but it doesn't, Madam Mim's not going to break the meta. And totally. Holy World is so important for so many decks that stall out, and I'm like, well, would it be fun if you had no option for Holy World?
So I guess let me caveat me saying a whole new world on a ban list as a Ruby Sapphire player and as a former Ruby Amethyst player, you know, who got totally smacked by a whole new world having to discard to be prepared, you know, because of a whole new world. So I totally get it.
That's true. You're like, who here has been personally victimized by a whole new world? I would raise my hand
sheepishly. Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, I would say as far as cards that I'm just like, oh, I would agree that Fox, you're just like, because you don't want to base your whole game around. That's something that I've learned is when I play conservatively because I'm afraid something's going to happen. Usually, I'm playing myself.
Yes.
But then also, you are sometimes playing right into a Fox, or if you're playing against Caleb, you're playing into a Stitch Little Rocket. But that's neither here nor there. Rush characters, they'll hurt you. They hurt your feelings. They hurt your characters. I think that's the biggest one is Madam Mim.
Yeah, if Fox was never banned, I would not be upset, honestly. Like, she, I totally get why she exists, and she is a fun mechanic. She's a very strategic card. I would probably say of all of these Sword in the Stone cards, and maybe of all the other cards in the game, she feels the most unbalanced that, you know, heavily helps the player, you know? But.
Yeah.
Hey, every color has that, you know. I like every color's got some cards that's like, okay, obviously this is going to benefit the player that's playing it. So
yeah,
that's like kind every of time the, that's kind it. Of the fun of a trading card game is getting to figure out like, okay, which best cards are you going to play with? You know, as a Ruby Sapphire player, I get to play with Maui. He feels a little unfair sometimes.
Yeah, and even Fishbone Quill can be. You're just like watching the other person just ramp and ramp. And you're like, okay, we've had enough. You have enough ink. We're cutting you off. So,
okay, you're at 14 ink already. Yeah, you've got enough, good. Buddy. Yeah.
So, so now, as we always like to do, armchair illumineering. Are there any characters or songs that, as you're watching the movie again, you're like, man, I hope I can see that one day?
Yes. So the songs that they have from this movie, I think, are quite interesting. One of them sees absolutely no play at all. And that's the Legend of the Sword and the Stone, which refers to the song at the beginning of the movie. And then they have Gruesome and Grim, which was our, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to say his name for the, fourth episode in a row.
Oh, no. No.
This is Alex Tech Card. Yes. Yeah. From his Ruby Amethyst deck back in January. And he had some good times with this. And it makes sense. I mean, getting to play a character with four costs for... or less for free. So that's immediately wanting you to play Goat, you know, because Goat has four strength. You give him Rush, he gets a lore, and then you can either bounce him back to your hand to get that second lore, or when he ends the turn and he's banished, you get that second lore anyway. So another song from the movie that I think would be really fun that is maybe my favorite song from the movie is Higgitus Figgitus, you know, when he's like doing his Mary Poppins thing of getting everything in the bag and, you know, it's all jovial and whatnot. So I thought it'd be, you know, he's putting stuff into a bag. And this isn't a reference to the bag from the comprehensive rules, but what I thought would be, you know, Amethyst has very little way to like deal with items. And that's probably by design to balance it out. So I don't know if this could really exist within Amethyst, but maybe something where all of the items on the field, like your side and your opponent's, like they have to get shuffled back into your deck, or like all items from the discard or something get shuffled back into your deck or something like that. I think could be kind of fun.
Yeah, that would be cool, because you're right. There's certain decks where I know after this week, I definitely know that items can, they can ruin your day. So anything yeah. that gets items at least back in the deck, that seems fair. You'll get it again. Yeah. It's just back in your deck. So
yeah. I'd love to see some more Arthur cards. You know, the two that we have are Dreamborn, one in Emerald, and then the one in Amethyst that we talked about. I think seeing some Arthur animal cards would be fun, as like a fish or as a sparrow. You know, they could be like one or two drops, and you know, they could just be thematic. I don't know if they could play into the whole Merlin and Mim thing, but would be kind of fun. And then I had another one, but I'm gonna let you take it, because we both had the same idea for this one, but I'll let you kind of expound upon it.
Yes, so we both, I was telling Caleb before we recorded, I was like, dang it, I read your notes and we had the same idea. But, and I yeah. think we're not the only ones, because I think I remember somebody at our league mentioning this, but obviously that wizard battle ends with Merlin becoming a germ, and that would be such yeah. fun. And I think we both had different ideas of what the effect could be, because one sure. I was thinking about is it would be like, as long as he's in play, you're opponent's abilities can't be used. So anything other than just questing and yeah. fighting, any special flair they couldn't use, because it'd be like a disease.
Like, so I thought, everybody becomes vanilla.
Basically, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, like, that's super cool.
Because yeah, basically he nerfed the sweet purple dragon.
Yep.
So I thought that would be fun. But what was your idea for the germ?
So yeah, my idea was he causes Mim to become sick, so she's like bedridden, so she can't do anything. And I know that Amethyst really likes to like exert characters and keep them exerted, like that mm-hmm. freeze ability that Elsa has. So I was thinking something like that, like maybe he's a super weak character, like a 0-1 or something like that. But if Merlin Germ is exerted, then like chosen opposing character can't ready at the start of their turn or something like that.
Yeah. I like that.
You know, so he's super weak and could probably easily, you know, be removed because he's a germ after all, but he also like makes somebody else unable to do what they're trying to do.
Yeah, yeah, and you'd have to have a removal spell or something in order to get rid of him. So I would like that. I was personally sad because I had heard chatter, someone being like, what about the germ? So like I knew a germ was coming into play, so I was like ready to see Merlin as a germ, and I was very yeah. sad that I did not get to see that. So that's a dream, is if you made this card, then we could see what Merlin looks like as a germ, which I did not get to see. But I imagine it would be like a little amoeba with a pair of glasses, maybe.
Oh yeah, and a beard.
Yeah, yeah, perfect.
That would be hilarious. Yeah,
so
yeah, so, Merlin germ, make it happen.
Yeah,
Ravensburger.
It's not too late. We can do the Rise of the, the Wizard Battle rematch, and then it'll make sense.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and then we can also have the Rhino and the Caterpillar thrown exactly. in there as well, because why not?
My other big takeaway is I do wish
yes.
there was more Archimedes, because
he was Can we talk about Archimedes for a little bit?
Yeah, he was so grumpy, and for what? Like, he was just so mad the whole movie. I loved him. He was just like a little grumpy owl, and I was like, well, we need more of that. Exactly.
It's hilarious. So the guy that voiced Archimedes is the same guy who voiced Rabbit from Winnie the Pooh.
That makes
sense.
So
I think that's kind of I see the overlap there. But Katie, you saw this movie for the first time.
Yes.
Just yesterday.
Yes.
Do you recall the unhinged laugh that Archimedes has when Merlin fails with the toy airplane?
Yeah, it goes on for a very long time. Yeah.
Katie, would I tell you that is like literally my favorite part of this movie every single time I watch it? Like, I cannot help but laugh out loud with Archimedes. If a listener at home, if you have not heard Archimedes like 20 or 30 second long laughing spell that he goes under when Merlin throws the airplane out of the window, it is so funny.
It really is. That's I think I think probably I typed the note in my notes. It's written Archimedes. I just like him. So that was my only reason that I wanted to see more of him. And so I think the laugh definitely contributed to that. Cause I was like, I just like this little guy. He's so fun.
So. He was great. It makes sense that he's a one drop 2-2, you know? But I'd like to see a little more flavor from him. You know, he's a little crotchety. He's a little know-it-all, you know, comes off as selfish, but risks his life several times for Arthur. So, you know, he has a genuine spirit.
Yeah. I appreciate him. I appreciate that he knows Merlin can time travel and he's like, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
He's a ride or die sidekick.
Just nonchalant.
Like, it's not a big deal. He teaches Arthur like four letters of the alphabet. He's a good character. I was a big fan. So, those are the things I hope to see. I also, one thing I didn't say at the beginning that I would love to see is some of that.
Yeah.
Color palette from the movie. There's this very distinctive color palette that you'll see in movies at this time where there's like browns and greens and pinks and blues mixed together. So I hope sometimes maybe they call upon the very very distinctive art style that sometimes
it's like it's very earthy and that, you know, going back to colors again, from my Lion King talk, but the colors did stand out to me. And there are some very notable moments where it is very bland, but then you do get some, I forget the name of the guy that comes in, but he's wearing like the pink and purple kind of shirt and everything. You know, he's got the mustache and he's the one that tells him that, you know, whoever wins the jousting contest is going to become king. That guy, you know, his outfit stood out to me and
It's a very pretty movie. I've said, I didn't always say positive things, but I will say I can see why this movie is iconic. It's beautiful. The characters are great. And obviously you can do so much with the tiny movie it was. I mean, it's an hour, I think, and 22 minutes. And obviously there's so much to draw upon on it.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, The Sword in the Stone might not be the most popular film in Disney Animation's history, but it still, you know, is that iconic film, as you were saying, has been for over 60 years, you know, it's been entertaining for generations. And, you know, although anyone who played against Amethyst in the past 4 months might disagree on how charming, you know, Madame Mim and Merlin really are, after they've been bouncing around and knocking your characters out and getting free lore and getting free cards without you being able to do anything, you know, they're still iconic characters. They're still charming. And, you know, they're firmly cemented in Lorcana from here on out, at least for the foreseeable future. So.
Exactly. So I'm glad we watched this movie. I know it was definitely, it was a quick turn from, you know, modern movies to old ones, but I think these old ones, they hold up.
Yeah.
Now, each week, we like to turn the mic to you, our listeners, to see what questions you have about Disney and the world of Lorcana. Now, this week, we actually have a question from a fellow Lorcana podcast, The Escape Pod. And that question reads, what do y'all hope to see in the coming set for franchises? So franchises maybe we haven't seen, or I mean, they didn't really specify. So I guess it could be more of some franchise we have seen or a franchise maybe we haven't seen.
Yeah, sure. So as far, I guess I'll start by saying, like, I am excited for Encanto to be coming out during Ursula's return. So, you know, that'll be a fun one. Some movies that I've like always had a deep connection to that I would love to see, one from this era actually would be Aristocats. I love that movie so much. It's fond memories from being a kid and watching that movie as well. The music is iconic, all that jazz music going on. You know, there's some good jazz music in Sword in the Stone for sure. All that kind of like 50s, 60s, even 70s movies, I think had some great jazz music, you know, The Jungle Book and 101 Dalmatians and whatnot. So the Aristocats would be cool. I'm just going to name animal movies.
Yeah.
Why not? The next one is Oliver and Company.
Okay.
I think Oliver and Company is so slept on as a Disney movie. Like Billy Joel is the voice of Dodger in there. And like the music is so good and the characters are so good too. And there's like the climax of the film at the very end, like the driving scene is like frightening. And I, yeah. So I guess I'll list those two for now. The Aristocats and Oliver and Company. I would love to see those in the game.
Now, this is going to be another, this is just an episode of me being like, I'm a Disney fan, and I'm being like, is she really? But I have not seen Aristocats. So every time I see a cat, I'm like, that meme of, is this an Aristocat? So I'm like, Sergeant Tibbs an Aristocat? Which then it just shows the other movie I haven't seen. It's terrible. So this is going to be half just me getting education on any Disney movie before 1970. But then
hey,
also,
fair enough.
So mine, I was thinking about this because I saw the question and I thought of one thing that I didn't think was possible, but the fact they're doing like Tailspin and DuckTales made me think it could be. And that is the show Gravity Falls. Have you seen that show?
I do not know that one.
Oh, so now I've seen
it. It's not even ringing a bell.
So Gravity Falls, it was on Disney.
Am I making a fool of myself?
No. So it was on Disney XD and it was like, in 2015 maybe, so okay, like you, you wouldn't have seen it unless you are somebody that sought it out, or so it's a very it's a very quirky animated TV show about kids who, it's this twin brother and sister, and they live with their great uncle or grunkle, and he works in a roadside oddities museum, and it's all about these like paranormal things, but it's very, very goofy. And man, I would love to have, there's this, there's this demonic.
I'm looking up photos right now and I've like seen these characters.
It's
before,
in the zeitgeist.
But I've never seen, but I've never seen the show itself.
So I would love a Bill Cipher. He's this like dimensional traveling pyramid with an eyeball and a top hat. And I would love a Bill Cipher card. I would love Waddles, Mabel, Dipper. I'd love all of it. It's such a good show. It's such a, every time it's fall, I'm like, well, it's time to watch Gravity Falls. So that's I thought it was
impossible. You're making me like this show.
Oh, it's so good. It's one of those shows that every, I don't like to rewatch a lot of things, but that's one that is just so,
that's one you'll rewatch.
Yeah. And it's funny. So hopefully if anyone out there agrees with me and you also are an adult that watched Gravity Falls, then let me know if I'm not the only one. But I'm sure there's at least two of us probably.
Yeah. Yeah, there's got to be. And what I would say in support of your choice would be, it seems like for the DuckTales that they went in on, you know, Into the Inklands, it seems like at least the art, if not the cards themselves, were very much inspired by the recent iteration of DuckTales from like 2018 or something like that, you know, which was obviously based on the older DuckTales from like the 80s and 90s. But it did seem like they were very, you know, the folks over at Ravensburger are totally fine with picking up a Disney TV show from the 2010s to make some cards after. So,
I don't even think you can find Gravity Falls stuff in the parks. Like it is.
Oh, really?
Disney XD is always kind of like this weird category where it is Disney, but it's not, you know, it's not on the same level.
Disney,
like
Disney.
Yeah, right. So we'll see. One day, a girl can dream. So that's my property that I'm hoping to see one day.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, so Escape Pod, thank you so much for your question. If you would like to have your question answered by us on the pod, please feel free to email us at questions@HakunaLorcanaPod.com. Or reach us on Twitter at Hakuna Lorcana. You send me a DM or reply to a post that I make on there, you know, we'll consider it for the pod for sure. And if your question is selected, we will send you an exclusive Hakuna Lorcana sticker for you to show off to all your friends at League.
Exactly. So yeah, and always feel free to leave us a like, a review or anything like that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to it. We really appreciate that. Now next week we're going rocketing forward 50 years, but we're staying with the theme of talking animals, and we're covering the 2016 film Zootopia. It's a film that leaves you wanting to try everything, but especially one of those strangely appetizing looking popsicles. So as always, thank you for hanging out with us. And until next time, Hakuna Lorcana means no worries.